Mashiach will be here this year.
Uh-oh, I think you better hear that playing back at the forums.
We didn't want Mashiach now. Okay, you're right. I better start now.
Why
don't
you
sing
your
key for us? Yeah. So they, the rep.
Too much laughing, too much loud talking. Somebody who, like, over to that and take a phone call.
Okay, fine. That's more important. The Rebbe was a big advocate of demanding Mashiach. Mashiach now, you still see bumper stickers in some places, Mashiach now, mm-hmm. And the greeting Mashiach from billboards.
Answering machine.
What?
Answering machine.
Answering machine, right. There's a woman in Chicago who's the principal of the Mashiachist High School, and I imagine other Babbagers do this. I just know because my wife told me when she answers the phone, she doesn't say hello. She says, Yichi HaMelech. So that's the greeting, right? May the king live. So I guess that has supplanted hello. I don't know if Alexander Graham Bell would have known about that. He probably would have used that. But all seriousness, this actually is a very, very big difference of opinion, not just concerning Lubavitch, but concerning a broad segment of Hasidim and Misnagdim. Reb Tzadok says, and Reb Tzadok was not a Lubavitcher, he was just a plain, generic Hasid. Reb Tzadok says, that we have a principle in the Torah. Actually, let me start from Mishnah. We have Mishnah Sota. The Mishnah at the end of Sota says that before Mashiach comes, the situation in the world deteriorates gravely. I just said some examples of how things are going to deteriorate just before Mashiach comes. And one of the examples of how things are going to go downhill is that there's going to be a lot of chutzpah. There's chutzpah yatsa. Chutzpah is going to become very, very amplified. Much, much chutzpah in the world. Many, many brazen, fresh, chutzpahdik people. So Reb Tzadok, in his inimitable style, says, if there's going to be so much chutzpah, there must be a reason for it. Not just a bad reason, a good reason. And he says, in fact, we can say the chutzpah yaska doesn't just mean there's going to be a lot of chutzpah, it means chutzpah will be uplifted. It will be a powerful tool. And he says, brings down, I think, from the Zohar, that chutzpah is a malkabli paga. It's a king without a crown. Because chutzpah is a very, very powerful tool. That's why, for example, we find the classic example in Chazav, Choni HaMa'agel. Right? Choni HaMa'agel, Choni drew a circle around himself. Anybody familiar with the story?
In time.
You know the story about Choni in the circle? Choni was one of the early Tanaim.
Oh, he's the one who went out there, drew a circle, and said, you make it rain or I don't go out of the circle.
Right. So he said, you make it rain. And God sent down a drizzle. Choni said, not good enough. So God sent down a storm, and the Holy said, not good enough. So God finally sent, easy rain. So then Shimon ben Shetach, who was the head of the generation, wanted to put him in Cherem for having done such, being so chutzpahdik vis-a-vis Hashem. But he said, what can I do? Obviously God listens to you, so not much I can do about this. So that idea is the idea of chutzpah klapei Shmaya. And chutzpah works even klapei Shmaya, even for Hashem, and even, this is for a good purpose. But even for negative purposes, the example Chazal gives is by Bilam. When Hashem told Bilam, don't go with the messengers back to curse the Jews. And Bilam said, I'm going anyway. So Hashem said, okay, fine, go. But I'm going to make you say what I want you to say. So the amazing thing is, let God tap him down dead, poof, right? You just can't go. Well, chutzpah works even vis-a-vis Hashem. Hashem gave chutzpah very, very powerful, very, very powerful ramifications. Now, okay, thanks. Okay, you're right. It's not perhaps the right way to phrase it, but Hashem gives. I don't know how to phrase it better. Chutzpah has great power. Rashi is on a Chumash somewhere from Chazal that the Torah was given to Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, because Yisrael are Az and Sheva Umos. We are the most brazen among the nations. And it says several times in the Torah, I'm Ksheyoich. We are, now you're arguing. Now you're arguing a Chazal, so you better be careful. The says that Jews are Am Ksheyoich, right? A stiff-necked people. So that actually is considered to be a good thing. Not, of course, it's bad on certain manifestations, but on the whole, it's good. And there's a difference between Ksheyoich, being stiff-necked, and Azus Pani, having a brazen face. Or we say on Yom Kippur, Al Chet Shechotonu Lefonecha, Be'azus Metzah. When we say vidui, and we mention the sin which we had, or sins which were caused by our having the trait of having a brazen forehead. Why? Because your face is supposed to be pleasant, nice, like Shammai says in Pirkei Avos, you should be makaba kol adam, savor panim yafos, you should greet everybody with a nice, you know, a nice face, you smile at people, right? So a person's has supposed to be easygoing with his face. But he's supposed to have a stiff neck, right? The Amshay Orech, the back. And that's in order to give the Jews the capacity to withstand adversity. That aspect of brazenness used the right way, they call it Azus Tekdusha. That Azus Tekdusha is something which the Jews are supposed to use in order to withstand all sorts of difficulties. There's a Chazal that says that when the Torah was given to the Jewish people, so there was tremendous. The Torah brings it down in this piece. It says that there was a tremendous uproar in the world, and the non-Jews want to know what's going on. Let me get down another piece, not this piece. And so they went to Bilam and asked Bilam, "What's going on?" So he says, so Bilam said, "Hashem owes Lamoitein. Hashem's giving this strong thing to his nation." And the Goyim responded, "Ooh, if that's the case, if he's giving this oath to this nation, Hashem yivarech esamo b'shalom. May God bless the nation with peace," which is the last line in the paragraph which we say before the Chododi Friday night and several other places in Dami. Hashem osamo yitain, Hashem yivarech esamo b'shalom. So the Torah there is called oath, right? Again, the Torah gives a person oath, inner strength. So that idea of inner strength is a positive one on the whole, okay? The Tzaddik therefore says that chutzpah has its time and its place. And he says it's true that chutzpah would not have worked beforehand. And the Chazal themselves warn, don't demand Mashiach. Don't even calculate when he's coming. Just do what you're supposed to do, and we'll talk more about that in a few moments. But he says, on the other hand, and there's also, he brings down from the pasuk in Parsha Shlach, it says there that after the sin of the spies, when the Jews were fated to 40 years in the desert, so then in Moshe, there are a bunch of Jews called the Ma'apilim who wanted to go up to Israel, you know, to immediately, and that was their they went up and against the Amalekites and fought a battle, and it all decimated; they were killed. So Moshe Rabbeinu told them, he advised them before they went, don't go. And he says, this is the language of the pasuk, v'hi lo tislach, this will not be successful. And they didn't listen. So the Tzaddik says, v'hi lo tislach means this one is not going to be successful. But there will be a time in Jewish history when, in fact, chutzpah, this brazenness, will be essential and necessary and will work. And he says that therefore, at the time, just before Mashiach comes, not way back in the time of Amoroi, time just before Mashiach comes, it is imperative that the Jews demand Mashiach. Yes.
Is there anybody who says that Zionism fulfills that requirement for the Chutzpahdik national movement?
The religious Zionists certainly say that. Mm-hmm. The problem with the religious Zionists, you know, in Kushner, I asked them, you know, I said, don't you guys get a lot of religious Zionism here? They said, no, we don't get any religious Zionism. So I said, well, what about all the pictures on the wall, all sorts of pictures and posters from the World Zionist Organization and stuff like that? They said, that's for the parents.
So even the kids are being influenced by the right wing?
No, they're not being influenced
by anything.
No, by nobody, right. There's no idealism.
They're just careful about it.
So the...
They're like, we might have to do a cookbook better. We're going to do a totally different thing.
The religious Zionists have a major, major problem with the Sharon's plan to give back Gaza, not so much because of they hold it's not good militarily, or you know it's a bad thing because for the state of Israel to give up land, bad precedent, but primarily it's a problem for them because they are of the opinion that there has been steady messianic progress made by the nation of Israel, and part of the messianic progress is the conquest of the land of Israel. And therefore, this flies in the face of their theory that there is this steady advance towards the redemption. If you give back land, that's the antithesis of what they regard as progress.
Is it the Gaza belongs to Israel, according to...
It was part of the promised land, yeah. It's a question if the Jews ever actually owned it, but it was part. It certainly was promised to the Jews.
It's the same place that Rabbi Yashuv and the same machlokes. Not machlokes, same.
So the religious minds do see that their movement is, and that's why they're willing to kill people for it, you know. They kill Rabin, and they'll probably kill Sharon if they get a chance. Let's be realistic, because they believe that this is the messianic imperative, and it's a very dangerous thing. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very perilous. When I was a religious Zionist years ago, I'm not saying I'm not a religious Zionist today, but let's assume I'm not, for argument's sake. When I was a religious Zionist years ago, when I was a member of Bnei Akiva, I couldn't understand why these people felt it was so imperative to go settle in the West Bank. You know, then the West Bank was really opening up in the early 70s. I said, you know, the Galil and the Negev are wonderful places for Jews to go live. Why do they have to go adapt to the West Bank? And in fact, today, the Galil has a majority Arab population, because most Jews are clustered like in the middle, and it doesn't make any sense. But in any event, far be it for me to assume that anybody has sense. The idea of Mashiach being demanded, therefore, doesn't necessarily pertain specifically to Chabad, but rather it could be seen as a more broader Hasidic idea, and the time for it is the time when Am Yisrael is very sore pressed and really needs the redemption. The question is what to do with the Misnagdic point of view, how to understand the Misnagdic point of view, and the Misnagdim were always very much opposed.
How can it be said that the Jewish people today are so hard pressed that even need Mashiach and need redemption?
No, not hard pressed physically.
Spiritually,
right.
It's
open, that's to relax. Right, we're too relaxed. Also, I think that the main reason we need Mashiach, or I don't know if Mashiach will come under these circumstances, is because of the terrible divides among the Jewish people, divisions, you know,
right,
which get more and more divided all the time, more and more subgroups divide themselves off.
Do you think it's going like to more divisions or less divisions?
More divisions.
Who adds up?
What?
What kind of divisions? Before, it's like a city in Spain, and now basically there is no more work.
No, they're back. It's back and so back in full force. Yes, in Israel just now the political parties divided up again. The Hasidim divided up from the Misnagdim. They have now two separate political parties, and obviously the Sfardim can't be in either of these parties, right? They have to have their own party, right?
So what's Machlokes and Hasidim and Misnagdim?
They don't like each other.
Okay, well, like real.
There's no real Machlokes. They just don't like each other.
Is that kidding? Hasidim don't learn enough.
I don't think so. I think individualism, it's not individualism, but I think the ever greater defining of boundaries within society is the trend. There's, my specific niche in Judaism and that person's specific niche in Judaism, who we're affiliated with, who they're affiliated with, and I think that gets worse and worse all the time.
Really what's causing it is the absence of oppression.
Right. It's true.
Oppression would unite together.
Right. That's what he's saying. Yeah. That's why oppression has been good for the Jews, right? Because then they don't have the freedom to do these silly things.
Well, in some ways, yes, in some ways.
Okay. There's a Gemara. I think it was in Bar Mitzvah, but I might be mistaken about that. Gemara says that the three things which come when you don't expect them, they are something that you lost. You only find it when you're not looking for it. Says the Hetzach Hadas, when you're distracted from them. A scorpion. Only scorpions don't come when you're looking for them, only when you're not looking for them. And Mashiach. It says Mashiach only comes when you're not looking for Mashiach, but rather you're looking away from Mashiach. So what does this Gemara mean? Why is Mashiach only come when people still look away from Mashiach? Moreover, this Gemara has to be reconciled with the other Gemara, which says that when you get up to heaven, they ask you four questions. They ask you, the first question they ask you is,
whether you will be more honest in your business.
Yeah, here are the questions. The article of translation, the authoritative translation. Rava said, when they escort a person who's final. Shabbos 31a. In the article 31a4. When they escort a person to his final heavenly judgment after his death, the heavenly tribunal says to him, did you conduct your business transactions faithfully? They couldn't. When I said this over to the Christian, they couldn't believe that. That's the first question they ask when they get to heaven. Whether you conduct your business transactions faithfully, trustfully,
well,
right? Yeah. I guess the spirit of Krishna. I was shocked. I mean, I couldn't believe that they asked him, what question would you like instead? So they said, I don't know. What? But yeah, they were shocked. I don't know why they were so shocked. That is the primary question. The people, were you a trustworthy, honest person in this world? Then they asked you, did you set aside 6 months for Torah study? Then they asked you, did you engage in procreation? Meaning not that you have to have kids, but that you have to attempt, to get married and have kids, if at all possible. And the final question, the third question they asked you is, did you wait for the messianic salvation? Then there are a couple of other minor questions they ask you. Did you delve into wisdom? When you learn Torah, did you learn it deeply? But in any event, the bottom line is that one of the questions is, did you wait for the messianic salvation? So if that's the case, it would seem that a person also has to wait, and anticipate Mashiach. So how do you say Mashiach only comes when you are not expecting him? If the Gemara seems to hold that you have to anticipate Mashiach, I would say in the Ani Mamin, Achakeh Lo, I wait for him, B'chol Yom Shiavo, every day that maybe he'll come today. They say that Rabbi Vachtvogel, who was the Mashgiach in Lakewood, used to go around always with a little suitcase packed in case Mashiach came all of a sudden and he had to hop on a flight to Israel. So he always walked around with a little suitcase in readiness for that moment. So the... So Rabbi Yosef Leib Bloch, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Tels in Lithuania, died. I guess he didn't want to waste a minute if he had a flight to Eretz Yisrael. Hey, if I had a free flight to Eretz Yisrael, I'd hop on it too. So he says an interesting thing. He says that Mashiach is a byproduct of Torah, tshuva, and mitzvot and good deeds. You can't demand Mashiach directly. You can't say, I want Mashiach. It's meaningless. Why should Mashiach come? Just because you want him? So what? I want a lollipop. I don't get a lollipop. I have to earn a lollipop. So if you want Mashiach, it's not sufficient. The way you get Mashiach is by focusing on what you're supposed to do in this world. And then Mashiach is a byproduct of that. When Am Yisrael does enough tshuva, mitzvahs, and ma'asim tovim, then they get Mashiach. But focusing on Mashiach is the wrong thing. Or, in Chabad, according to their philosophy, they stress that one should do mitzvahs in order to bring Mashiach. Right? The doing mitzvahs is a way to bring Mashiach. But we others maintain that one should do mitzvahs because they are mitzvahs. Because they are things which are Hashem told us to do, and they're good for us and good for the world, and not just because they're going to bring Mashiach. So it's a very different approach, and it's an approach which is more, so to speak, holistic. In other words, you really have to focus on the totality of positive results, not just on the specific results of Mashiach. So the analogy I like giving for this is that it was a secular Jewish philosopher, a very famous one named Viktor Frankl, who writes that happiness can only be a byproduct of a meaningful life. In other words, you can't strive for happiness directly. The only way you can become happy is by leading a meaningful life, then you are happy. You can become thrilled, exhilarated, ecstatic, or joyous. There are all sorts of things you can become, by going on a roller coaster, by drinking, by doing all sorts of other fun activities. But to become truly happy, it's only a byproduct of having a meaningful life. His theory that most people who suffer from depression and other maladies suffer from them because they are So they don't feel sufficient meaning in life, in a whole theory called psychology. So it's just like happiness is only a byproduct of meaning, so too Mashiach is a byproduct of the Jews doing a meaningful thing. But what about this? Gemara says, you know, they ask me when you get up to heaven, did you look forward to the salvation? So I think that the idea is that not the same thing as Sipisa l'Mashiach. It doesn't say, did you look forward to Mashiach? It says, did you look forward to the salvation? Somebody asked me also today that when it says to Davni, to kabe shofar godol chavuseinu, to blow shofar for our freedom, to saw neisal kabe chavuseinu, and lift up a flag, you know, for to ingather exiles, isn't that also demanding Mashiach? And again, I said, that's not demanding Mashiach. It's not asking even for Mashiach, really. It's asking for a redemptive state. Then I said that even if it is asking for Mashiach, it's asking, not demanding. But in any event, the point is that Yeshua is a state in which the Jews are able to function at an optimal level because there is no more oppression, right? And no more oppression doesn't just mean no more physical oppression, but also no more factors which lead Jews astray, such as temptation, right? Temptation is diminished because there's a universal recognition of God. So therefore, when it says you anticipate Yeshua, what it really means is, do you anticipate such a situation? And the great advantage of that is that even though you might not in your lifetime see the actual redemption, nevertheless, you will be living on a higher level by virtue of the fact that this is your ideal. If you focus on this, this is something which is a very powerful thing for you. It gives you a different plateau of existence than you otherwise would have had. That's how one, I would reconcile these two Gemaras. The one which says you should not look for Mashiach, and the one which says you should look forward to the redemption. It means not that you should look forward to Mashiach coming in of itself, but rather you should meditate and consider the redemptive state, and that should be something which has an impact on your daily life, even in our day and age. So the bottom line is, I think, that there are two irreconcilable positions, both of which have validity in Judaism. That's really a beautiful thing about Judaism. We have lots of irreconcilable positions which can both be right. So this is one of them. That there is a legitimate source that would say one can and should demand Mashiach, and there are legitimate sources that would say one should not focus and one must not demand Mashiach. And each one has its own perspective and its own sources in order to prove the point. But in the final analysis, everybody agrees that the purpose of the Messianic Age is that the purpose, it's a sense according to the way we understand the Psach Halacha and the Gemara, it's not really a Psach, but it's not really halacha, but the Gemara's conclusion is that there is no difference qualitatively between this world and the time of Mashiach. So therefore, the whole difference is that we will be free of all the negative influences which lead us astray when we're under the influence of foreign powers and foreign ideals. That's something which will be taken away. One other thing I wanted to say about the topic of Mashiach before we close out the topic is that according to the sources which hold that Chiyas HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, is either at the very end of the 6,000 years of this world or is in the world to come. So only a very small portion of the Jewish people experience Messianic times. So only the people are going to be alive at that time, which, and you know, it's getting less and less all the time. So it seems quite clear to me from this that the idea of Messianic time is to bring the world to closure, where all the loose threads come together. And therefore, I said this in my Kushal class the other day, and one kid was very disturbed by the idea. I said, I don't see why Mashiach has come any more than 5 minutes before the year 6,000. He didn't like that. But what I said was, if the whole point is to bring all the threads together so you can reflect and contemplate and see how everything in this world had a purpose and everything was part and parcel of that, you know, progression towards its culmination, so then why does it need more than 5 minutes? 10 minutes, an hour, a few days, and that's it. But in any event, even if it lasts longer than that, that's the idea, that everything will be brought to the ultimate culmination and that all the threads, you know, like we say, all everything which happened in the world will be retroactively understood to have been something good that had a positive outcome in the long run, even in the short term it seemed like a bad thing. That's the ultimate purpose of Mashiach. the people who don't experience Mashiach, the Jewish nation who's alive at the time, is like the tip of the Jewish nation, which is one large body. It's also true about non-Jews. All the generations are interconnected. There's a strange medrash, just as an example. The medrash says that when Esav came to make Yaakov, he came with 400 soldiers. And when Esav started going home, so all the 400 soldiers, you know, fell away one by one. And it says that as a result of those 400 soldiers falling away one by one, Rashi brings this down, they were rewarded many years later, that 400 years later, that when the King David waged war against Amalek, 400 Amalekites were able to escape unscathed. This is very strange. You know, it's certainly not the same people. You're rewarding those 400 people back then by the 400 people that much later. So, of course, you know, if you're a Kabbalist, you could say, well, Gilgal, right? They came back as a reincarnation. But even if, obviously, you have to say that there's some interconnection, or the inherent interconnection between generations. Everybody is bonded together. And therefore, there's this fixing which takes place but experienced even by the last generation of people living in the Messianic era, which then has, which then fixes up all the generations retroactively, and even though they don't experience it directly, they too, by virtue of perceiving what's going on in this world, and the Shamas can't perceive what's going on in this world, also see how everything Hashem did was for the best. There's one other thing I want to add, which is that it seems, you should know, that it seems that even the Shamas in Shemayim do not know the future. Okay, in other words, you don't. The reason why they have to wait till the time of Mashiach to see how all the threads came together is because they don't know what's going to happen. There's several proofs for this. The primary one which one can give is that it says that when Hashem at certain points in history goes to the Avos and says, okay guys, the jig is up. We have to kill off all the Jews. They're being bad. So, and the Avos, you know, they respond, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. You know, the question is though, don't they know it's all a game? They know the future, don't they? Don't they see everything works out in the end? And the answer is no. Even the Shamos and Shamayim don't know what the future will bring. So therefore, they also finally enjoy the fully developed tapestry as it spread out before them at the end. And the mashal I gave for this is a mystery novel, right? A well-structured mystery novel leaves you in the middle in very, very, if it's really well written. You know, I'm a big Nero Wolfe fan. I don't know if that's meaningful to any of you, but if you're a real good author, then everybody's going to be totally confused and in the dark in the middle, and everything in the end becomes clear retroactively. And so too the Bria works, how everything becomes clear in the end, how all the threads, all the clues led up to this final conclusion. And we'll conclude here.
You're going where?